Hey, everybody, it's Joe Trippi, and welcome back to a very special guest episode of That Trippi Show. Our guest today has recently talked to Dahlia Lithwick about her book on heroic women's attorneys fighting injustice, Paul Krugman on inflation, the economy, and how it's touched by just about everything, and Neil Katyal, former Solicitor General, on whether Merrick Garland will indict Trump or not. And that's just his last three shows. And I hope he doesn't disagree. Well, he can disagree if he wants. But we think we have an even bigger get today. Al Franken himself on today's show, the only former U.S. Senator currently on tour and host of the Al Franken podcast. Al, great to have you on. Thanks for being with us today.
Well, thanks for having me, Joe. Yeah, my next guest is Sarah Silverman.
Oh, cool.
So I do a lot of public policy. I don't do news of the day, because there's plenty of news of the day out there. And so Neil, when I had Neil Katyal on, I didn't want to hear what, you know, the 11th Circuit cited that day. I wanted to do just an overall view of what Garland's choices were. So that's the kind of thing I do. And I do have every once in a while friends who are comedians, because I am a comedian. I'm on tour right now. As you said, right. It's the only former U.S. Senator currently on tour. But, you know, Sarah cares about politics, too. So we have her on, and that's going to be a great one. We dropped that on Sunday.
Yeah, no, I love listening to him. That's why I mentioned the last three shows have been just fantastic. And it just shows the different array of guests and the way you look at things. The one thing I wanted to talk a little bit about is the tour. I noticed that I think you had your last show a few days ago, and then you start up again in December. Is that because you're going to be more political in October, or is that just taking a break?
Yeah, I'm doing a couple things that unfortunately coincide. I'm getting some back surgery, which is very good news. I've had a bad back for about 35 years. Bill Walton is a friend of mine, and he's a friend of mine because we're both Deadheads. And I was at Citi Field in Queens when Dead & Company did their last show, and Bill was there, and he saw that I could stand up and dance for about 10 minutes, and I had to sit down. And he said, Al, what's the deal? And I told him, I have the bad back, and I had surgery 30 years ago. It didn't do me much good. Bill famously has benefited tremendously from back surgery, and he got me this great surgeon in New York. So October, I'm getting back surgery. It'll take me out for a little bit. But before that, I'm going to Wisconsin to do some campaigning there. And I have a PAC, a political action committee, and I give a lot of money out to Democratic parties, Democratic candidates. We'll talk about the midterms, of course. Also to the Hospitality Workers Unite here, who do the best ground game in the country.
Yeah, they're great. I was trying to trace back. I think you and I met standing in line somewhere in the Dean campaign. I mean, I was in the Dean campaign.
You were running the campaign, so why were you in line?
I don't remember. probably because I just wanted to hang out with you. Okay. When did you catch the political bug? I mean,
always had it. You know, my parents were very interested in politics. We watched the news every night while eating dinner. We had tray tables, and I remember my dad was a Republican until 64, and you can probably guess why. Changed. And I remember watching Cronkite, and there were these demonstrations in the South, and Bull Connor was putting dogs and billy clubs and fire hoses on demonstrators. My dad pointed to the TV, said, "No Jew can be for this." And he finally became a Democrat in 64. We lost the South. We got my dad. And I've been political ever since. I wrote a lot of the political satire on SNL. And what really got me to run for the Senate was I was a good friend of Paul Wellstone's, and I campaigned for him. And of course, in October of 2002, he had a vote on the war, and he was against the war in Iraq, but a large majority of Minnesotans were for it. And he told me and a lot of other people that he thought this was going to be the end of his career, because he was in a neck and neck race with Norm Coleman. He voted his conscience. He voted against the war. The next poll had him up by 7 because Minnesotans actually expect their politicians to vote their conscience. And then he died in a plane crash very soon after. And 3 months after he came to office, Coleman said, to be blunt, I'm a 99% improvement over Paul Wellstone. And when he said that, I said, I wonder who's going to beat this guy.
Looking now and, you know, today with what where the Republican Party is, how did we get here? How did we get from, you know, the party of John McCain, you know, reaching across the aisle to Lindsey Graham's national abortion ban and candidates like Oz and Herschel Walker and Blake Masters?
Well, of course, that's a huge question.
I know.
That's the question, yeah. Right? And but I think I have an answer. I wrote this book, Rush Limbaugh is a Big Fat Idiot and Other Observations, back in 95. And then I wrote Lies and Lying Liars, Who Tell Them the Fair and Balanced Look at the Right, about
that's
Fox,
a great book.
Not long after. Thank you. And what those were about was the right was just telling lies and that it was dangerous. And turns out
you were ahead of everybody on that one.
Yeah. And, you know, Rush got the Presidential Medal of Freedom from Trump for a reason, because without Rush, there's no Trump, I don't think. But, you know, this is Buchanan. This is Gingrich. This is Limbaugh and on and on. And there's been this far right. This has been part of our nativist right wing politics has been around forever. And then we have Trump, and that has put us to a point where, and all these guys, you talk about Lindsey Graham, you know, Lindsey Graham just caved, as they all did. And the Republican Party now has ceased to participate in good faith in our democracy. And that's why this election is so important. It's crazily important. And I do want your listeners to go out and door knock and phone bank. I assume your listeners are voting, of course, but get on the doors. You know, I always say this to people I'm speaking to when I do my tour. You know, a lot of you have jobs, a lot of you have families. Ignore them. You know, an 8-year-old kid knows how to use a microwave oven. That's just fact. An 8-year-old kid can teach a 4-year-old kid to use a microwave oven.
Yeah.
Go out there and door knock.
Yeah, we've been preaching that quite a bit in our podcast. And this is another time that we can plug jointheunion.us, folks. If you want to get involved, it's a great place to sign up and get out there and knock doors.
Al, I'm glad you brought up the Rush Limbaugh book. Joe, I'm going to skip ahead to one of the things we were talking about pre-show, but you wrote that op-ed for the New York Daily News last year, and I quoted the last line from it because I think it's really important and gets to your point. You said, "The most dangerous problem facing America today is the existence of two universes of information. The second universe, a universe of disinformation, has been expanding since 1989. Rush Limbaugh was the Big Bang," which I think is a pretty good way of summing it up. And so what else are you seeing about ways that the best way to fight that?
It's really hard because these two universes, America is divided into two universes, and people in the other universe from ours that's where they get their information. And we have this terrible division that has just been, of course, exacerbated by Trump and by this disinformation and by social media. I mean, if you think about it, Rush Limbaugh's a Big Fat Idiot. It was about radio. Lies and Lying Liars, A Fair and Balanced. Lies and Lying Liars, Who Tell Them Fair and Balanced Look at the Right was about Fox and about cable TV. Social media since then has just expanded this to it's now people just get their information in different places and they lie. They have no compunction about it. And a lot of people are making a lot of money off it. And it's disgusting. And all we can do is keep trying to get our message out, but it's really, I don't know the answer to how to bridge this at all.
I mean, one of the things that just strikes me, again, that whole sort of evolution that you just talked about, radio, you know, broadcast cable, and now fragmentation on the internet, is that they've, on the other side, with Murdoch, the Koch brothers, and, you know, have spent 30, 40 years building this outrage machine that's not just Fox, it's Breitbart, it's OAN, it's Newsmax, it's a zillion alt-right websites. Yeah. And there's just been no, that's the mainstream media, it's not their, they're just never going to be the thing that fights that. And so I keep struggling with how we build a pro-democracy platform or something that is the same thing. I mean, that we're investing in, we're all trying to spread that message and take these guys on. But, you know, it's hard to get anybody to fund something like that, unfortunately, because they just don't think the threat's there. And don't see the threat.
It was interesting when we did Air America, which was underfunded.
Yeah.
I mean, that was our enormous, that was the problem, which is we couldn't get good signals.
Right.
We didn't have enough money to buy, you know, and we didn't have a billboard.
Right. Yeah.
And radio billboards are really important because people, when they drive around,
yeah,
see billboards for radio.
Yeah, but that's so, the whole point. We can't, I don't, you know, because I've been out there trying, you know, we're trying to you know, get people to sort of fund
it all. I get a call once a year, once every other, you know, how do we put this together? You know, you need billions of dollars. And then it's also like, I just, it is like one hand behind your back, which is where we kind of tell the truth.
Yeah, right.
So, and so it's still by its nature. Also, I think the internet, by the way, has dumbed down people completely. You know, when people go on Twitter, it's let's just reduce everything to what'll get the most hits, which will be the most outrageous, stupid stuff and something. We have, I think, part of our problem too is our country's getting stupider every day. Not to insult people.
Well, yeah, no, but consuming fewer facts. I mean, because of the fragmentation, they just can't possibly know enough.
And you look at something like Facebook and the idea that they don't know what their algorithms are doing or have no control over them. The algorithms are there to feed people stuff that they want to get that'll keep them on. And in a lot of cases, that's stuff that'll agitate them. They know that.
Right.
And so the algorithm sends them exactly what'll do that. The algorithm is literally doing what they say they have no control over. So I think Section 230 is something that we can look at, which is basically something that was, what was the Internet Decency Act or something in the early 90s, yeah. Which had, it said that these things are platforms and not publishers, and therefore can't be held responsible for what they put out there. I think we have to revisit that. That was a First Amendment,
yeah,
a pro First Amendment thing, and I'm all for that. But we have people just being fed disinformation deliberately by these platforms.
So one of the things that I wanted to get to as well, though, is you said on CNN that sort of getting into other parts of where the right's coming at us.
Mm-hmm.
You said on CNN that the stolen, you know, SCOTUS seats under Trump destroyed the legitimacy of the court.
Mm.
And so we have these corrupted institutions and not a lot of momentum to fix them. You know, we have the Electoral Count Act, but
I even worry about that because that basically says, yeah, whatever the state sends. And then now you have this court that Neil Katyal is actually arguing. This North Carolina case, which is arguing that the state legislatures have the authority basically to do whatever they want in terms of elections. And so they can be sending the fake electors to the Senate. They can determine who supposedly won the popular vote in their state, or they can pretty much do whatever they want according to this case. And four justices took it, you know, and that's extremely dangerous. But so what was the question? Well, I forgot. This is so scary.
Yeah, no. That's what I was trying to get at, because they're
short circuits my mind sometimes.
Yeah, they're doing this in the courts. They're changing state laws in the legislatures. You know, that we're seeing. Yeah. They've got this outrage machine.
This is why one of the things that my PAC is doing is funding the secretaries of state races. Because those are very important.
Yeah, in a lot of ways, they may be the most important. In some of these states, they're more important. Look, all the Senate seats and the House seats are important, but
everything's important.
Yeah. But that's the point. You know, one of the things that I've seen on my side, you know, is somebody who manages campaigns or a strategy.
I think Nadler is going to win. So if on the Upper West Side of New York, don't door knock for Nadler.
No, but. This is the point I was going to make off of your Secretary of State comment, is that people need to stay in the booth all the way down. Yes, vote for Senate, vote for governor, but stay all the way down. Go through Secretary of State. Stay in the booth and vote. I mean, get out there, knock doors. But
And every state is different. In Pennsylvania, the governor appoints the Secretary of State. So the governor's race there is so crucial. Also, they have a nut.
They have nuts everywhere.
Everywhere. They're the Trump endorsed candidates are by and large nuts. You got Walker and you have Masters in Arizona, right?
Yeah.
And Vance in Ohio. You have, and then you have just your garden variety already existing nuts, Ron Johnson.
Yeah.
But these are all amazingly crucial races.
Well, I think that's why we have. I still maintain that's why I think we have a shot in a lot of these places, because if we keep doing the work,
clearly Pennsylvania and Georgia are races we should be able to win. Pennsylvania is a pickup. We need at least two, I think. In order to do some reform of the filibuster.
Ah, that's what I was. One place I did want to get to too. How do we fix the Senate? You wrote an op-ed with Norm Orenstein, a great friend of
the pod. He's been on.
Yeah. How to fix the filibuster? You know, tell us about your encounter with Jim Bunning and why you think flipping from 60 to end the debate to 41 or continue it would make a big difference.
Well, at the end of the first week in the Senate, and the Senate ends the weekends, these votes on. Thursday, early evening, coming back, and then you go to your office, then you go to the airport, and you fly home for the weekend. So I'm getting on the subway in the basement there, and Jim Bunning, who I didn't know at the time, was just a nasty jerk. I didn't know him yet, and everyone will acknowledge that. And, you know, the guy's passed, so I'm very sorry about that. But anyway, so I say to him, Jim, have a great weekend. I'll see you on Monday. He goes, oh, I don't have to be here on Monday. It's a cloture vote. And I realize that, oh my God, that's right. We have to get 60 votes to get cloture, to break a filibuster. They don't have to do anything. They don't have to show up, right? I guess they have to have one.
Yeah, right. Yeah, you know, somebody's going to be there, but that's about it. Yeah.
That's it. So I called Norm. I went like, God, that's screwed up. And we started talking about it. And we thought that why not just reverse it? And you have to have 41 votes to sustain a filibuster. So that way, the people who are actually stopping things and filibustering would have to show up.
Right.
and so we've been working on this for years now. And when, I was talking to Manchin about it. And I, at one point, Manchin indicated that he was going to do this in something that was secretly taped. He did a conversation with Third Way, I think, which is kind of this supposedly middle of the road organization Norm and I had said was that to keep a filibuster going, you need 41 votes, and those 41 have to stay on the floor. If you have 50 senators in your party that want a filibuster, you can have to have 41 on the floor. So nine can do other stuff if they want to, but, and they have to actually debate. Everything has to be germane, no green eggs and ham. Just you have to speak to the issue. And I would have loved to just have seen that on voting rights. I would have loved to have seen that on any of this. And I was talking to Joe, but at a certain point, I lost him. And obviously sent him a two. But that's not what I was telling Joe. Joe said, well, I have Robert Byrd's seat. I said, this doesn't get rid of the filibuster. It reforms the filibuster and actually makes it much more like what the filibuster was supposed to be, because the filibuster used to be rare. And McConnell is the guy that broke that. McConnell filibustered as many executive nominees during the Obama administration as had been filibustered in the entire previous history of the country. McConnell broke the Senate.
Yeah, absolutely. You're right there. So we've talked filibuster and court. Which is,
so if we pick up two, we have a shot at that, at reform, right? Not getting rid of it.
Yeah. Do you think, I mean, what worries you more? I mean, the court right now, or I mean, which would you everything, I guess.
Well, the problem with the court, of course, is that the only solution there is to add the justices that we lost,
right?
Which is four, a net of four, because Garland, that was unprecedented what they did. Yeah. And McConnell, you know, said, well, you know, the Biden rule. Right. Well, he did a speech and he said that you won't. And Biden didn't say that we won't take up a nominee. This was, I guess, Bush's last year. So right. It must have been 92. So in June of 92, he gave a speech on the floor, Biden, and he said that if someone wants to resign, this is not about a justice dying. This is about someone resigning in June, if someone resigned, in order to be replaced by another conservative justice.
Right.
He said, we'll take up a nominee, but you got to either confer with us or just nominate a moderate.
Right, right.
Consult with us. And Obama had consulted with Orrin Hatch. Orrin Hatch had said Merrick Garland would be a perfect choice. And I, in the Judiciary Committee, just railed. I read the friggin' Biden speech. And these guys, you know, it was cynical. And if Garland had come up, America would have just impressed if he had had the hearing. And so there's that one. And then you remember Lindsey saying, keep the tape. If a seat comes open during an election year after the primaries have started, Trump as president, that we will not take him up or her up. We will not take right. that up. Keep the tape. Use it against me. And then, of course, Coney Barrett was sworn in like 8 or 9 days before the election.
Yeah.
And so that's why I said on CNN, this is an illegitimate court. So what's the solution? Well, you can say, okay, that's a net of four. Those would have been two of ours. So we should just be able to appoint four, and then it would be 7-6. And then the problem with that, of course, is that eventually they'll get the presidency and
do it again,
control the Senate, and they'll do that.
Right. Yeah.
And that's sort of, where does that go? But theirs is the original sin on that. So, but the way for us to do, we have to win
right.
this election, and we have to elect two, we have to get a net of two more senators so that we can do some filibuster reform. And another thing about that reform, by the way, I hate to go into.
No, that's why we have you on.
Yeah, is that it will restore to what it was, which is that the majority isn't going to want to have the floor tied up. So what will happen is there'll be there's no motivation now to negotiate, to compromise by either side right now. None. But to prevent a filibuster, then the side filibustering, that's a lot, Grassley isn't going to want to stay up.
Right.
20, you know, have 23 or 21 hours. I've done the math, right. You know, and neither is McConnell. And
right.
And so they don't want to do that. And we don't want to just have we need the time.
Right.
When you're in the majority, you need the time. So that would create compromise. And that's what I was trying to tell Joe Manchin.
Yeah. Well, we definitely need compromise. Alex and I both worked for Doug Jones' race in Alabama, and you know he was a big person in terms of trying to reach across party lines and get things done. And
he's in Alabama.
Yeah, yeah. No, but I mean, I just don't see anybody that on the other side right now who's even approachable. You know,
it depends on the issue. Yeah. They did it on, on infrastructure,
sure,
of course. And that basically House Republicans didn't. Thank God we have a majority there. But we got, I don't know how many, 10 Republicans or more, at least, obviously, to do it in the Senate. And there are other things on the CHIPS Act, which, there are certain things you get bipartisanship on, but they're kind of no-brainers. Yeah. The fact that we didn't get an infrastructure bill during Trump is amazing.
Yeah. Is it?
One, he ran on it. Two,
it's infrastructure week for 4 years. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I was there during a number of the infrastructure weeks.
Well, look, the one thing, it does seem like Democrats have really been turning the tide over the summer, both in momentum post Dobbs and with several big wins that some of them you just mentioned, things like the Inflation Reduction Act under Joe Biden, climate change, student loan forgiveness. How would what do you see as the winning message now for the midterms? I mean, what would you prescribe for Democrats to be doing these last, six, 7 weeks?
I would run on those accomplishments, which are very major. I mean, finally addressing climate.
Right.
It's huge. And if you want to get young people voting, they know that they see what's happening and they know what's in their interest. And that's $370 billion finally. Then you have Medicare, seniors, you have Medicare now is going to, on some drugs, going to be able to negotiate,
right,
which with pharmaceutical companies, which is a huge,
yeah, reduce thing. Those costs.
And on insulin, it caps the price of insulin for seniors. It starts to tax corporations that are, corporations that would tell their investors that they made a profit, but send something the IRS said they didn't. So in the finance committee, they changed how you report. So they're now going to be paying taxes on the actual profit they're making. So some really good things happen in that. I would also run on our democracy at stake, because I think people know that. And I think our people know that. And so I think that's an enormous issue. And of course, abortion is a huge, huge issue.
Yeah.
And that is about this illegitimate court doing something that was settled law for, I don't have to tell everybody, 50 years, and it's 49 years. And, that's going to animate. You saw what happened in Kansas.
Yeah.
59-41 in Kansas, right?
Yeah, I know. And there's a lot of, there's a big surge in women registering to vote and younger people registering to vote since then, too.
So yep.
As a comedian,
yeah, as you can tell, I've been hilarious. Yeah,
No. But how do you find humor in politics today? I mean, it seems a lot harder with the stakes, for our democracy so high. how can it be used as an effective vehicle? I mean, the thing that brings us to mind is your tweet on Lindsey Graham. You know, understand this is a matter of deep principle for Lindsey, just like when he declared Trump a race-baiting, xenophobic, religious bigot. There was humor in that in a way that I think made a point.
My first career and now my eighth career is comedy, and that's my love, and I'd done stand up with Tom Davis. I don't remember if you remember Franken and Davis, but
sure.
I started in high school with Tom, and we were two of the original SNL writers, and but we did stand up, but as a team, and we were very, I don't know if you know Bob and Ray, but we were very Bob and Ray influenced. And so once I left Senate, I started doing speeches, and I realized, you know what, this is mainly funny. And so I said, I could do it. Why don't I just get rid of the podium here and do stand up? So I started working out at the Comedy Cellar. And yeah, I bring in, and stuff changes, you know, since I started this tour, we went, Russia invaded Ukraine. And it's fun to go after. I go after Tucker Carlson a lot. You know, the day before Russia invaded, he said, you know, Democrats say we should hate Putin, but why?
Right. Yeah.
You know, has he ever called me a racist? Has he sent our middle class jobs to Russia?
Yeah.
Has he tried to cancel Christmas? And I said, you know, he's right. Putin hasn't done that. And yet I used the F word, hate Tucker Carlson. You can use humor for anything. And sometimes the darker, the better.
Should more of you guys run? I mean, I'm just,
More comedians.
Yeah.
Well, what I found is that sometimes it's used against you. Everything you do is
every
put
joke
through the dehumorizer. So, that was the case in my first race. It was, and it's hard. And ultimately, I can understand why comedians don't want to do it.
Well, there's a lot of good folks who don't want to do it. That's also part of the problem, I think, I've actually, you know, thought again as somebody who manages a campaign, you sit there and go like, why is this guy going to put up with what's about to come down? I think a lot of good people haven't run because of exactly that.
Yep. And we get a lot of bad people.
Right. Gets down to, I just want to, can I?
Or mediocre people.
Well, when it comes down to your only question is, can I win? Or what do I got to say to win? Then it's, you know, when that's the kind of the key motivator,
Democrats want to know that their candidate can win.
Yeah.
So you don't really want a candidate going in like, you know, the reason I'm running is to make a point.
Yeah, no, you don't want to do that either. No, you don't want to do that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't care if I win.
Yeah.
I'm a refreshing candidate.
Yeah. So before we go out, I just wanted to ask about your relationship. What's your relationship like with the president, with Biden? And what is he like in person? I think our listeners.
Well, I know Joe for a while. I mean, I got to know him when I was in the Senate, and I saw him at the Mondale Memorial last, I guess also at the Harry Memorial.
Yeah, I was at the Mondale Memorial.
You know, I think, you know, a lot of people criticize him, but he's accomplished a lot. He's really accomplished a lot. And also, I think he's led this coalition brilliantly on Ukraine, which it's tragic. And it's tragic that we have to do this, but we have to do this. And I think his leadership has been tremendous on that. And these latest accomplishments, it took a while. We had and I was arguing a year ago that we should just put the elements of Build Back Better on the floor. Because if you, and they'd lose because Republicans wouldn't vote for them, I don't think. But if you think about it, like universal pre-K, unbelievably popular and unbelievably the return on investment,
right? big
for pre-K is enormous. Yeah. And it's a brilliant thing to do. There are all kinds of things like that. A child tax credit. We really should be doing that. And there may be an opportunity to do that. There's a in the 2017 Trump tax cut, they put a ticking time bomb on getting rid of the corporation is taking a deduction for capital investments that they can now take the full deduction in the first year they make the investment. But now it's going to spread out over the future. And they put that in to score it for scoring purposes. And it's going to, that's now the clock. It's going to end the ticking. And we may have an opportunity to give them that in exchange for a child tax credit, which we know reduces childhood poverty. And we know the research, what it does for just even kids' brain activity.
Right. Yeah.
For their parents not to be that anxious for them to have food, you know, healthy food. Yeah. It's unbelievably stupid not to do it. And maybe we can trade that.
That'd be great. I got one last question. I think we saw you on Jimmy Kimmel talking about that you might consider another run.
I don't think I talked about that on Jimmy Kimmel.
Well, maybe it was.
I think you're hallucinating.
Supporting but, another. I think it was you were supporting another unrelated Franken in Iowa. But what is next for you? What are you?
Well, I'm keeping my options open, but in the meantime,
That's a very good answer. I would advise
thank you,
I would
advise. Campaign manager. I'm keeping my options open, and that's my official position. And I'm concentrating on the. I love touring. I love doing stand up. It's been wonderful. I've done, I don't know, I just did one in Long Beach 2 nights ago. That's why I'm on the West Coast. I have grandchildren here. So I'm here in LA right now. So there's that. And also I have a political action committee. As I say, I'm traveling with Wisconsin. I'm trying to support as many Democrats as I can in what I consider the most important races and in Minnesota, which are very important races. Secretary of State Steve Simon there. We need to take the state Senate there to give the governor, and we need to reelect the governor. I'm very active right now in trying to make sure that we elect the right people so we can govern well.
Well, I think all of us hopefully follow that lead and get out there, knock the doors, keep up the work. And Al, you know, thanks for coming on, and thank you everybody for listening to that Trippy show. We will put links to the upcoming tour dates in December in our show notes, as well as the Al Franken podcast. And I mean, people, I'm telling you, you should listen to that podcast. It's a really different
one. With Sarah is actually, I've just been listening to it for, you know, we edit these things, and God, it's great. It really is. So is the one with Dahlia, which is up right
that's
now.
That's the one I just got done listening to. That one.
Isn't she great? Yeah. She's amazing. Your listeners who don't know Dahlia Lithwick, she writes about the Supreme Court for Slate, and I think she's does the best commentary on the court. And she's been the guest most frequently on my podcast, but this book is so inspiring. It's called Lady Justice, and it is about these women, many unheralded. Sally Yates, I guess, is the best known, but who have stood up and done incredible stuff for justice. And I'm very proud of the podcast.
No, the podcast is great.
Originally, I was going to do I started about doing a podcast on cuts of beef, but there were already 12 podcasts just on brisket, and 7 of them were really good. So I decided to do what I'm doing now instead.
Well,
the Al Franken podcast.
Yeah. Thanks, Al, for for coming on the show. You can find tickets on Al's upcoming tour dates at alfranken.com and check out his podcast, The Al Franken Podcast, available on the platform of your choice. You can find it the same place you found this one. We'll be back next week. Please subscribe to That Trippy Show and leave a review on Apple or wherever you listen. You can always send us a question to thattrippyshow@gmail.com or leave us a question in a review on iTunes. See you next time. Thanks, Al.
You bet. Thank you, guys.